Okay, so first of all, thanks everyone for coming despite the nice weather, even though I'm saying less here than in most other places of the world. Then I'd like to thank Ashwin and the other organizers for putting together this very nice workshop. And I'd also like to thank them for putting together a program which isn't too packed and for nonetheless finding time for me to give this presentation here. Thanks very much. Before starting, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So it's always a bit hard to single out individuals, but I guess the people who've done the heavy lifting for what I'm going to be talking about here in the Loop project was Ludovic Jobert, the Bionic Coulomb phase, Vedika Kimani, our graduate student at Princeton, and the 3D RVB phase, Fabrizio Albuquerque and Fabien Ali on the numerical simulations there. I probably won't have time to talk about the flat band work, which I'd be more than happy to answer questions for if anyone is interested in detail. And I forgot, I also would like to thank Hirokazu Tsunetsugu for keeping to his allocated time slot. That was very considerate. Okay, so Ashwin's asked me to give at least a brief overview of kind of things that I think are interesting at the moment. So I've just prepared one slide, so otherwise I will not keep to my allocated time slot. But I'd just like to list things here which I think, well, which certainly I'm excited to be thinking about at the moment and which I think are interesting for the bigger picture. So one thing which is of course at the center of this workshop is the question, what do spin liquids look like? Where do we get spin liquids? And I think one of the necessary and interesting questions one has to ask is what happens if you look at spin liquids in the presence of disorder? For a number of reasons which are really separately interesting. So one is disorder is a fact of life. So if you say have some candidates for liquid compound, you look at the inverse susceptibility, you find that no matter how hard you try, you always get a Curie tail in the susceptibility at low temperatures, which is due to disorder. And if you want to understand the experiment quantitatively, you need to address this. Then, of course, disorder is interesting as a diagnostic. Just think of the Haldane chain with its three spins a half if you cut it in the middle. So if you're looking for spin liquids, actually spin disorder may be giving you the kind of smoking gun that you would otherwise not find. And then, of course, there are new disorder type phases, like in this cartoon of an infinite randomness fixed point, which, again, are interesting by themselves. And I think more broadly, if you go back to the heroic calculations that Max presented yesterday, so once you've done all of this, then you understand what the low energy physics of a spin liquid looks like, and then you have to ask, if you now have a real compound like this work, which is motivated by DMIT, then what of this actually is going to be robust, and what of it is going to be modified in the presence of disorder. And I think this group of questions really is very interesting. I think this is a good time to study it. I'm not going to say anything about this. I think we just had a talk in that general direction. I think the general question, if you somehow marry frustrated lattices with attenuant degrees of freedom, that obviously has cross connections to condo physics and all sorts of other things, what happens? And there's also some interesting topological physics there. Then it has been a staple for a long time to think about material realizations of these spin liquids. So that's a long ongoing search. At any given time, there tend to be a couple of compounds that people are most excited about. And as I'm saying, so a combined understanding of what new kind of phases we expect from a theoretical or microscopic description together with the question how this gets folded into real experiments is particularly interesting. One thing I'd like to point out is that whereas the descriptions that we look at tend to be asymptotic low energy descriptions, I mean, this is what field theories of condensed matter are good at doing. Often it's also interesting to look not just at the low energy degrees of freedom, but also at the full spectrum. Even though the full spectrum may be somewhat less universal at high energies, it may nonetheless be very characteristic, like in the case of a Heisenberg chain here, theory by Jean-Sébastien Cohen's group and the experiment by Alan Tennant's group, where it's really at high energies where you see the physics of the two-particle, two-spin-on continuum and neutron scattering that you learn a lot about the underlying physics. So similarly, I think one thing that would be quite desirable is if we had more two-dimensional exactly soluble models, or if we looked at those that we do have in considerably more detail, not just with a view of what happens at low energies, but also with a view whether there are any high energy, perhaps not quite universal, but nonetheless very characteristic things to look at. And of course, one thing that's been a big topic here is that two-dimensional DMRGs emerging as a method which may very well supersede other numerical methods in the not-too-distant future, and I think that's also a very exciting development. Anyway, so that's my incomplete list. There's also a lot of other things that I'd like to tell you about, such as the physics of fluctuation-induced ordering, which I think will also be a topic of next week's workshop. So I'll just skip that here and leave it at that list. Okay, so on the way to discussing how extended degrees of freedoms come about, I'd like to talk about how gauge fields generically can emerge in strongly correlated electrons. I'll be brief about this because this is something, these ideas have been around for a long time, and especially here at ITP, or rather KITP and even ITP, before the K was added, there have been activities here for many years. So as long as I've been around physics, I can remember work by Chetan, Matthew, all the way to now Leon in this field. And I think I'd just like to briefly summarize the kind of input that I need for what will be the physical motivation for the problems I'll be telling you for the rest of this talk. So of course, the high energy degrees of freedom are spins. We tend to look at spin systems or adjacent electrons in one way or another. And then there are some interactions which impose a constraint. So this constraint can have many different origins. So one is simply the quantum dynamics of singlet formation. So these are these pictures due to Phil Anderson and Roxak-Hillerson, which led to all the RVB theories, of which there are many exponents here in the audience. So basically, if you have a spin which can only form a singlet with one neighbor, then that precludes it forming a singlet with another neighbor. And if you now want to parameterize your degrees of freedom by who's a neighbor with who, then you naturally are forced to have a constraint which says only one neighbor. And this is then a hardcore constraint. A spin a half can't form two singlets with its neighbors. There's a local energetics which can give you a local constraint, such as in spin ice, where on each tetrahedron, two spins have to point into the tetrahedron, and two spins have to point out of the tetrahedron. You can, again, basically then insist that this sort of total magnetic flux into a tetrahedron is divergence-free. Whatever flows in flows out. And then again, this is local energetics, which gives you a hard constraint, which you can then impose in the limit of low temperatures and low energies. Then they very generically come out of slave particle treatments, as we heard yesterday. So basically, you take an electron, you break it into two pieces, and what these two pieces are is something that you can decide depending on which saddle point you want to look at. And then at some stage, there's payback time. You have to face up to the fact that physically you can't have any combination of these slave particles at any given site. There, the fact that they are derived from the high energy degrees of freedom then reasserts itself. And then this is often and this is then enforced by gauge constraint in practically the way that Max explained yesterday. Okay, having done all of this, you can then end up with a situation where the low energy effective degree of freedom is a gauge field rather than a spin. So this has the advantage that it's local, but it's often a redundant parameterization because there can be local gauge invariance, so that the sort of physical degrees of freedom are then really different ones. So you might not want to look at exactly what the gauge field is doing locally, but rather say what the fluxes are doing of the gauge field locally, or what the gauge charges are doing. And the kind of physics you get out of that is spin charge separation, so where the gauge charged objects now are sources and sinks of this gauge field and magnetic vortex excitations, which have been termed bisons. And one of the challenges in all of this is that just because you can rewrite the degrees of freedom in terms of a gauge field doesn't mean that the effective low energy description actually is a gauge field. And as Max was again describing yesterday, this means that you have to worry about whether or not this entire description is actually stable and physical when you include the fluctuations of the gauge field. Okay, so that's more or less the motivation for why one ends up with a description where the new degrees of freedom are really much more gauge-like than single particle. Okay, so the examples for fractionalization, I've just given electrons converted into holons and spinons, or Laughlin's case and function quantum Hall case, the Laughlin quasi particles, and you can get fractional charge and so on. So, of course, you know, many ways of getting new particles, and the fact that there are new particles as a matter of principle is as old as the world itself. But one thing I'd just like to point out is that we very rarely actually encounter the situation where we actively think about extended degrees of freedom. Of course, there are extended degrees of freedom which are very prominent in many fields of physics, such as in polymer physics or the physics of cosmic strings. But in magnetism, we typically encounter them, say, as domain walls, D-minus-1-dimensional objects in D dimensions, and the particles that are listed here tend to be point-like particles, the kind of quasar particles one likes to think about. But once you think about gauge theories, it becomes very natural that you start thinking about flux loops, which are now extended degrees of freedom, and you can ask questions about what is the statistics of these flux loops. What I'm going to be doing in the remainder of this talk is giving you three examples of where this is realized, two in a classical setting and one in a quantum setting, where it will turn out that the concepts that are going to be used are going to be very similar, and where one learns some new phenomena, where one gains some new insights about the systems in question by adopting this perspective. Okay, so magnets as loop models. I'm going to be introducing loops and strings and worms in the Kuhnau phase, so that's one particular topological phase of magnetic systems. So I'm going to be discussing easing and bionic pots, Coulomb phases, and the pyrochlore lattice. And then I'm going to be addressing implications this has, say, for the Castellane transition, which I'll explain, and numerical simulations. Then I'm going to switch gears to a quite different physical problem, even though the analysis is going to be quite parallel, resonating valence bond physics, and thinking of that as a loop soup, which I'll remind people of what it means. And in particular, we'll find that there's going to be coexisting Néel order with sort of more characteristic Coulomb-like dipolar bond correlations. Probably not have time to talk about that. Okay, so let me first introduce these extended degrees of freedom pictorially. So think about pyrochlore-type lattices where you have either tetrahedra or squares with crossings in two or three dimensions. And the constraint I showed you earlier was that there are basically two spins pointing up and two spins in and two spins pointing out, which you can alternatively think of as two blue and two red spins on each tetrahedron. And then there are two ways of defining extended degrees of freedom in this context. So one is what we call loops. You basically take a spin of one color, red here, and you connect it with its red neighbors in both directions and so on. And then since there's always two red neighbors, what you end up with are non-intersecting loops which are red and blue and which between them visit every side of the lattice. So this is also known as a fully packed two-color loop model, which is related but not the same as some models which were studied by Condev and Henley about 10 or 15 years ago. There's a second object which turns out to play an important role conceptually and also for numerical simulations, which we called worms because they are the objects which appear in worm algorithms. So this is defined differently. So basically you start with a blue side, and then you randomly pick one of its red neighbors, equal probability, and then with a red neighbor you randomly pick one of the blue neighbors, and so on, and you continue with that until you come back and the thing closes on itself, and this is then what you call a worm. So as I say, the reason it's called a worm is because in Monte Carlo simulations you flip the colors along this worm in a worm algorithm. Okay, I will, in the following, not particularly carefully distinguish between loops and worms because it turns out that their statistics in the settings that I'll discuss is going to be very similar, but it's worth bearing in mind that there are slight distinctions, and if anyone's interested in the more fine detail, again, they're more than happy to either interrupt me or to catch me and discuss these separately. Okay, but basically these are going to be the actors. We have our hard constraint, which gives rise to this emergent gauge structure, and in particular the worms turn out to be flux loops of the emergent gauge flux. And then we're going to be asking questions about the statistics of these extended degrees of freedom. Okay, so let's have a look at the statistics of these loops. So the first thing that you find, this is from numerical simulations, that there's an algebraic length distribution of these loops. So there's two-dimensional, and here's the three-dimensional probability of having a loop of length L versus the length L of the loop. And what you find is that the simulations for many different system sizes nicely collapse onto one power law. If you do the same thing in 3D, you actually notice that there's a qualitative difference between 2 and 3D. So again, you have an initial power law, but then there's a crossover to a second power law, which is now lower. And so there are now visibly two distributions. And so there's a obviously fundamental distinction between these two, and that fundamental distinction turns out also to be related to the different properties of these spin liquids in 3D, which are not quite realized in 2D. So what are the what is the new thing about this loop distribution in 3D? Well, if you look at it in more detail, it turns out that these two populations correspond to two different geometric behaviors of the loop. So this was done for periodic boundary conditions, and the details of this depend on the boundary conditions. But if you imagine working with periodic boundary conditions, then a loop has two options of closing. One is that it comes back to where it started from, and the other one is that it comes back to a site in a periodically continued version of the unit cell, but not in the original unit cell. And so these we call winding and non-winding loops, and the non-winding loops are the short ones, and the winding loops are the long ones.
What is L over L squared bigger than 1
mean? This is little L over L squared.
Oh.
So big L is the system size. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. That is not very visible. Yeah. So this L is just rescaled so that you get the correct collapse, and the little L is actually the free parameter. Okay, so we have these two populations, and the long loop here, long loops really have a number of important properties. So one is that a finite fraction of all the sites live on each of the longest loops. There's a number of order one of the longest loops, each of which has a finite fraction of the total number of sites in the system. And it turns out that the total number of spins which live on the non-winding loops, that is the entire distribution here, actually only contains a rather small fraction of the loop, 6%. What we also find is that the average length of the loop is finite in both 2 and 3D. So in 2D, the average length turns out to be 24, and in 3D, it turns out to be a rather number of order 1, but a rather large number of order 1, namely 227. And the reason for this you can basically understand in the following way. So we've got a loop length distribution here, and this loop length distribution is such that as you look at higher moments of it, this here is the last moment, the average loop length, which is actually still finite. If you go to higher moments, it's no longer a finite number. So basically what this 227 tells you is that whereas you still have a finite average loop length, you're really very, very close to having a situation where the loops become very long indeed. Okay. And so then the effective descriptions for this in terms of field theory are quite different. So the effective description of this turns out to be critical percolation. So the power laws that you find for the 2D case are those characteristics of critical percolation. And in particular, what you find is that for a system of size L by L, there's order one loop which winds around the system, and all the other loops are finite. Whereas for 3D, the effective description for that is the probability distribution of Brownian walks. So let me say a few things about that. So Brownian motion in 3D is different from 2D in the sense that if you start a walker at the origin, in 2D it basically always comes back, whereas in 3D it's got a finite probability to escape. And basically these non-winding loops are the Brownian walks which have escaped from the origin. So that's the physical description behind that.
These are winding loops.
Sorry? These are winding loops, right? Not coming back means you basically randomly then sample all the space, and eventually you just happen to hit the spin in the your origin in a neighboring side. Okay. Right, and for that reason, it's basically also sensitive to boundary conditions, because if you had reflecting boundary conditions, things would look slightly different. Okay, and the if in particular now, if you look what is the probability for two spins to be in the same loop in the pyrophore lattice, what you find is that this probability goes to a constant number, basically because the long loops, which have a finite fraction on the sides on each of them, mean that there's a finite probability for any pair of sides to be on one of these long loops. So the connection between this and the fact that in 3D you have this deconfined phase is then rather transparent, because what basically happens if you generate a defect, the defect in the three-dimensional model has, say, something with a gauge charge. So if you create a defect, the net gauge charge has to be zero, so you get a sort of a plus charge and a minus charge defect. And the point now is that since the gauge flux connecting these two is completely tensionless, that's just a statement that you basically have these very long loops here, you can cheaply separate the two gauge charges, and this is why the excitations are deconfined. So the connection, therefore, between the behavior of the gauge flux at long distances and the fact that it's very cheap and doesn't show any line tension, and the fact that excitations are deconfined, is very intimate. Okay. So let me now say something about how to observe this experimentally. So the way you observe this experimentally is that you, so this is in a somewhat different setting. One of the things about worms is that they're not uniquely defined. But it turns out you can make them uniquely defined by applying a field in one direction, say in a 1-0-0 direction, so that the spins on each tetrahedron, so the spins pointing in were the red points and the spins pointing out were the blue dots, that they satisfy both the magnetic field energy by pointing along the field and also the constraint by having two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out. And then what you hit is what's known as the Castellane transition, namely if you can now ask what is the free energy of reversing a spin. For reversing one particular spin, you have to pay a Zeeman energy, but at the same time you also gain an entropy, because if you just imagine having one of these worms going through the system, as you go from this tetrahedron to one layer down, you have a choice of two spins to flip. Here you have another choice of two spins to flip, and so on. So when the Zeeman energy basically equals to T log 2 from the entropy, you start nucleating these strings. If the temperature is less than that, you're in a completely frozen state. And if it's higher than that, there are these strings which make a random walk, with the one direction being the time direction and the other two directions being the spatial directions. Then from that you see that if you want to visualize or probe this worm using neutron scattering, what you expect is the Fourier transform of a random walk correlator, with the two spatial directions being one direction and the third spatial being a pair of directions, and the third spatial direction playing the role of time. So this you can do using neutron scattering. So there's neutron scattering data here, and the simple model based on the random walk of the string there. And what you find is that you see these characteristic regions of high diffuse scattering around here. And basically, these then tell you that the simple random walk model for these extended degrees of freedom is appropriate. You can also then refine this by tilting the field, getting a biased random walk, and then the data and the model change, and they continue to track each. Yeah, but this is one example where you actually have one of these one-dimensional magnetic degrees of freedom in a three-dimensional system, which is very unusual, which you can see in neutron scattering experiments. Now I'd like to say a few words about what the relevance is of this is for the numerical simulations, because as I mentioned earlier, the algorithms in Monte Carlo flip worms. And what's particularly nice is that the length of the worm is weighted, that the probability of choosing a worm is weighted by the length of the worm. Basically, if you choose a spin at random, then the probability that it's on a loop of length L is proportional to L. And as I said earlier, then this moment no longer exists, so in three dimensions, it turns out that each Monte Carlo move flips a finite fraction of the spins in the sample. So no matter how big the sample, you basically need of order 5 or 6 Monte Carlo moves in order to completely decorrelate the sample. And this is very unusual, and this is what allows you to really simulate gigantic systems. In particular, you can then probe aspects of the system which would otherwise be very hard to access. So there's some unpublished work by Stephen Powell, who looked at precisely the Castellane transition with the additional feature that he allowed the ice rule to be broken locally and weakly. And then, since the Castellane transition has as its upper critical dimension 3, precisely the spatial dimension that we are looking at, he looked at the logarithmic corrections which you get. So here is the mean field theory, the points are the numerical data, and then the red line is the theory including logarithmic corrections, which was worked out in terms of the fugacity of the defects, their density, and the reduced temperature. And what we found, plotting this appropriately, is that there's a very nice data collapse for systems which can be quite gigantic and reduce temperatures and reduce fugacities, which range widely but which themselves are quite close to the critical point. Okay, so I think I'll probably skip the bionic Coulomb phase. You have to ask me about this separately. I just, before going to the quantum case, would just like to mention one further thing. Actually, let me skip that. You can ask me about that as well. This is really interesting, but it takes too long to explain. I don't want to overrun too much. Okay, so. So just to lead over, so it turns out these concepts are very interesting and useful for different settings. So in particular, you can look at POTS models where the basic underlying structure remains the same, but details, say, of the matter content of the theory change. You can look at you can look at disordered magnets, where it turns out that the geometrical arrangement of ionic disordered magnets itself imposes certain types of possibilities for long-range order in the presence of quench disorder, which are very unusual and which can be fractal and so on. But what I'd like to move on to now is the discussion of Niel and dipolar correlations in resonating valence bond wave functions. So again, this is something that this audience will be rather familiar with. So resonating valence bond wave functions were proposed originally as a parent of a superconducting state for the cuprates. Basically, they model singlet dominated phases, where the idea is that, as I mentioned in the earlier slides, that two spins form a singlet, and then since the singlet covering is not unique, and singlet coverings are not orthogonal, you get some quantum dynamics, and then you can ask, if you add quantum dynamics, do you end up with some crystalline phase, or do you end up with some spin-liquid phase? So in the square lattice, it's known that generically you have long-range order in the energy correlations, so in the dimer correlations, but you don't have Niel order if you look at the simplest quantum dimer model. However, if you change the kind of dimer states that you are allowed to write down, it turns out that you can even have a crossover to Niel order. Okay, so the bond correlations, as I said, tell you that you are really very close to valence bond crystallization in 2D, and this is again something that has been studied exhaustively. But one of the simplest questions you can ask, if you now simply take a simple resonating valence bond wave function and stick it onto the cubic lattice, what are the correlations which are encoded by this resonating valence bond wave function? So in particular, the one that one looks at is one motivated by Roxanne Kiversen. You sum over all valence bond coverings, and just with an equal amplitude, and then you ask, what does this RVB wave function have encodes in terms of correlations? So you're not even asking the questions which Hamiltonian gives you that. It's just, if you're saying that this is just about the most non-magnetic wave function you can write down, so this should be very close to an RVB liquid, you actually get an RVB liquid out of this. Okay. The reason this is a question you can answer is because there's a very elegant way of simulating RVB wave functions, which was formulated by Kevin Beach and Anders Sandvik. And in particular, with this, you can compute correlators between the spins, going back to ideas of Sutherland's in the very early days of RVB physics, where you basically just get contributions to the spin correlators under the following conditions. So if you find that the wave functions are sum over all dimer coverings, so expectation values are sums of dimer coverings in the Brown and the Ket. And it turns out that you get a contribution to the spin correlators provided that the sites I and j sit on the same, on one loop, which you get when you take the d and the c valence bond coverings and superimpose them. So if there's an I here and a J there, there will be non-zero contribution if the superposition of these two valence bond coverings contains a closed loop joining these two, and otherwise it's going to be zero. So it becomes a completely geometric question: what's the probability of two superimposed dimer coverings to have a loop between these two sites? And now you see where the connection comes to what I was saying earlier. These are basically just another way of constructing these loops, and what you find, if you do numerical simulations for the cubic nearest neighbor resonating valence bond physics, the loop soup, so the distribution of loops, again has two populations. It's got the non-winding population, it's got the winding population, and it turns out the winding population, if you remember, implies that for two sites to be on the same loop has a finite probability. That just means that you end up with near order when you translate it back into the observable. So just by looking at this loop distribution without doing any further calculations, you can read off that there's a long-range order, and basically the probability to be in the same loop is proportional to the near order parameter. So that's quite sobering. So the simple cubic resonating valence bond wave function, which you can write down, actually has magnetic order. So this is a very common topic when you study frustrated magnets or non-near states. The effective field theories in three dimensions have a much, much easier time to be deconfined than the ones in two dimensions, but destabilizing the competing Néel state is much harder in three dimensions than in two dimensions. So here, the loops do the best that they can, so they're really floppy. At the same time, Néel order basically parasitically comes out of that. Okay. Now let's look at what the bond correlators do. And it turns out the bond correlators have an algebraic dipolar form with a power law which is different from that of the Néel state. It's actually 1 over r cubed, which is relatively slow, and it basically has a non-trivial angular dependence. And this is characteristic of these magnetic Coulomb phases, so of these topological phases like the one you find in spin ice. And in that sense, this wave function, even though it has Néel order, is still different from the conventional Néel state. And now the next question is, how do you model this in detail? It turns out, and we haven't concluded this yet, but it looks like you have to model this using two emergent gauge fields. So there's basically one gauge field, which the gauge flux of which is shown here, and then there's another gauge field, the gauge flux of which is related to the bond correlators. And it turns out they're independent in the sense that by deforming the model, for example, by going from SU2 spins to SUN spins with larger n, or by decorating the lattice, you can actually confine this one field so that you kill the Néel order while you still preserve the dipolar bond correlations. So in other words, even this very simple RVB wave function has a rather intricate emergent gauge structure with two emergent gauge fields, and we're currently looking at in more detail how to model this. Okay. Okay, one thing I wanted to mention is that there's a rather cute connection of all of this to what is well established in the physics of polymers, and that's the following. So these loop models, which I mentioned earlier, are actually fully packed loop models. So it may come as a little bit of, so that means that they avoid each other, but they also in particular avoid themselves. So it's this is not unlike the difference between self-avoiding random walks and Brownian walks, because as you know, self-avoiding walks, which must avoid themselves, have a different, fractal properties from Brownian walks. So you might naively have expected, since these guys are self-avoiding, that perhaps they shouldn't be modeled by Brownian motion, but rather by self-avoiding walks. But something that's well known in polymer physics is that if you've got polymers in dense solution, basically the need to avoid yourself weighs about as strongly as the need to avoid everyone else, and the statistics you get out of that then bring you back to Brownian motion. So that's one of the insights we get here. So these fully packed loop models are actually, despite their self-avoidance, modeled by Brownian motion. And it turns out that in two dimensions there are many different properties of self-avoiding walks which have different fractal exponents. And one thing that would have been hard to predict in all of this is which of these would have applied to our fully packed loop models, because it turns out that microscopically it would have been consistent with several of these. Okay, so let me summarize. So I've tried to motivate for you why it's interesting to look at magnetic extended degrees of freedom by starting from asking the question, where do emergent gauge theories come from? Then from that you naturally get emergent gauge fluxes, and then you can ask what are the properties of these emergent gauge fluxes, which in some systems actually turn out to be very natural and physical quantities. This is what I tried to motivate by looking at these so-called Dirac strings and spin ice, where the worms essentially become quantities which you can directly probe using neutron scattering. So in spin ice, we've got these loops in the worms. We've got this fractal order, which I didn't say much about. We have these direct strings and neutron scattering, and this some insight into why worm algorithms are so efficient in three dimensions in these deconfined phases. Didn't have time to talk about that. And the other thing I talked about was the physics of loops and RVB states, where I noted that you can have coexistence of the Coulomb phase-like dipolar four-spin order, while at the same time having long-range magnetic order, which if you deform this system, you can turn on and turn off independently, so that the effective description of that is in terms of two gauge fields. Thanks very much for your attention.
You emphasized these two populations of loop, mm-hmm. but suppose I have a 3D XY model in terms of loops, mm-hmm. and I can do simulation, a loving winding or not a loving mm-hmm. winding, it will still go into superfluid phase. Mm-hmm. Its bulk property should not be sensitive to the boundary conditions.
That's right, which is why I only mentioned it's sensitive to the boundary conditions, but I don't think the physics I'm discussing here is. So if you basically had reflecting boundary conditions, I think what would simply happen is that the loop which has disappeared just gets reflected and keeps moving inside one sample before finally returning as well. But I would expect it still to visit a finite fraction of the sites in the sample.
Okay, so you do not think it's bulk is not sensitive to that other.
I think the physical consequences of this are not sensitive to this, to the boundary conditions, but the details of which this would look like naturally, I think, would be sensitive because the loop will quite simply have some memory of where it came from if you force it to reflect and avoid itself as it gets reflected, but I don't think these are going to be influential for the universality properties of this model.
I just following up on that question, how important is it that your loop, because it's every that these are fully packed loops, and is it just same in universality as 3D XY or?
Well, I mean, it's Brownian motion. So the question, so there clearly is a limit where if you had only a single loop, it would be different because then it would be self-avoiding random walk, right? So I don't know where there will be such a transition, but as a matter of principle, whether you're fully packed or almost fully packed probably doesn't matter, but the density of these loops certainly has an influence of what the statistical properties are.
So the Diels-Neville dimer RVB in 3D says over each other, if you have minus signs in the sum, would you get long range
order? So I guess it wouldn't have long range order, but I could also not do the simulations. No, I mean, there are good reasons to believe that you wouldn't have long-range order because one of the reasons you have long-range order here, of course, is that no matter how long the loop is, it always adds with the same sign. So they're really one thing I didn't emphasize here. So if I just ask the question, are they in the same loop or not? And then I always add a positive number. So even if this number then became positive or negative, without there being a weight which itself is positive or negative, probably would destroy this. If you go to a non-bipartite lattice, not only do you get positive and negative signs from this, you also would then get positive and negative signs from the weight. So you would expect it to go down, but of course the weights are also positive and negative in the denominators, you have to be careful. But I can't simulate resonating Van't Hoff functions with a sign problem, so I don't know.
In 2D, what happens? Can you remind us for lattice, this kind of wave function, is it short range?
It's short range now, and it's also got the, it basically inherits the properties of dimer model, classical dimer models with a stiffness which is different from the classical dimer model which you get if you just think about dimer-dimer correlations. And you actually see that the way the stiffnesses work there, already people didn't notice it at the time, although they noticed something weird was going on, that the stiffnesses move in two directions which seem to be mutually exclusive. And the reason, you know, depending on whether you look at, say, monomer correlations or dimer correlations, and the reason is that you're probing different gauge fields. So you can basically think of, very roughly speaking, if you take symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of the heights, so this is one height model, this is another height model, the symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations, if they're completely uncoupled, have essentially the same stiffness, but if you start coupling them, the stiffnesses move in two different distinct directions. And this is reflected in the 2D calculation as well. You don't get Néel order, but you do get signatures in the, say, relative exponents of the soft mode compared to the resonant mode.
Maybe another question I had was the 3D. You said there are two gauge fields. Mm-hmm. Does the Néel order exert on the gauge fields?
Yes, sir.
Néel order, does it damp the gauge fields?
No, so the statement, so it's very like what I just said about the height model. So you then have the 3D version of the height model, which is just a simple vector potential. You can again think of taking symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of this. The fact that both, basically the Néel order comes from the fact that one of these gauge fields is deconfined. So that there is this second, you know, that the fluxes have no tension. And then if you confine that, so that this tensionless, that the fluxes do get the tension, then the Néel order goes away. Mm-hmm. That's the other way around.
Mm-hmm. If I were to describe it as a phase, as the Boltzmann modes of the Néel order, but it also has some photons?
Now that's a good question. So for one thing, we don't quite know how to describe it as a phase, or rather than as a phase transition. So the Goldstone mode is probably different because really the dispersion of the Goldstone modes has implications for how the bond correlators should decay. And it looks like if you take the standard sigma model, you get exponents which are not, you know, you get the Néel state exponents and not these exponents. So we don't know exactly where the break occurs, but this is not a conventional Néel state. It may be that it's got an anomalous dispersion of the Goldstone mode.
Questions. Speakers.